Mark Greaney is a New York Times bestselling author many times over, and the mind behind the Gray Man series. The 13th installment of that story is out now. It's called The Chaos Agent. Mark is now nice enough to join me for a few minutes to talk about that and a whole lot more. Mark, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. And congratulations on the 13th installment to the Gray Man series. That would be The Chaos Agent. And this one takes a little bit of a different turn. We do still have the Gray Man, but we also have artificial intelligence really coming into the picture now. And while people will frame this as a book about the perils of artificial intelligence, in a lot of ways, it is about the perils of man and his attempt to go Kid Icarus with artificial intelligence and see just how close he can fly to that digital sun without the wax wings melting and having us all plummeting to the ground in the process. What was the initiation of this idea to infuse artificial intelligence into the latest Gray Man novel, Mark?
You know, for the last couple of years, I've been very interested in the civilian world's development of artificial intelligence and how the militaries were trying to sort of rope the civilian world into it. And I guess I started out with the premise that it was the militaries that were the danger. But the more I learned as I started researching it, you know, these all the big billion-dollar civilian companies that are making the most sophisticated artificial intelligence, they're a danger in themselves. And I thought, you know, gosh, as a thriller writer, you're always looking for what's trouble. And you know, I just saw an Elon Musk type character who could be sort of on the dark side and trying to develop something that is an artificial general's super intelligence that could, you know, that sort of reframe or just revolutionize war as we know it. And so from there, I just, you know, the story is about my hero, the Gray Man. And so it's a boots on the ground type of a story, but it does have these bigger technology issues at the back of it.
That's right. Capitalism can and is a great thing in a lot of ways, but when you get somebody who has nefarious intentions and they create something this powerful and they're not necessarily looking to do good with it, they're just trying to find the highest bidder. At that point, it becomes a bit of a burden for the rest of humanity.
I agree. I mean, I think it's fueled by ambition and greed and, you know, everybody, there's the old Michael Crichton line from Jurassic Park where talking about, you know, genetic development, I think he said something like, you know, everybody was so busy asking if it could be done, nobody asked if it should be done. And I think that we're in that stage again with a new revolutionary new technology.
And one other thing I love about this book, Mark, is that you don't have to take any liberties with technologies. You made it a point to only use technologies that currently exist as a part of this book. And that might be shocking and eye-opening to some people. They may think that some of these technologies are a few years off, but no, that is not the case. And as a matter of fact, it's like we get new headlines every day with regards to ChatGPT all of a sudden dropping certain ethics with regards to allowing robots to think for themselves or artificial intelligence to think for itself with regards to warfare or running simulations, and the computers all of a sudden just get new cappy. So this is stuff that is in our reality right now, even if it's in its infancy and it does seem like it's flawed in a lot of ways. We just need to think back a few years to realize that none of this even existed 5-10 years ago, or it was still in the developmental stage. So who's to say what's going to happen or what it's going to look like in the next decade?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I stress that there's nothing in this book that's science fiction. Everything's either existing or emerging technology. Maybe I've done some things with it that, you know, I haven't read about other people, you know, doing with it as far as the plot. But it's all stuff that's out there. And, you know, a lot of people say, you know, the best AI is not that sophisticated yet because, you know, they asked it to write a paper for them and it made some mistakes. But just as you said, 5 years ago, this was nothing. And 10 years ago, I think I read that since 2010, computer hardware expenses to build the big AI models has increased 10 billion%. And the data being used doubles every 6 months. So, you know, a lot of resources are being poured into it. These technologies are able to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and teach themselves things a lot faster and a lot better than we can teach them. So it is, there's a danger of this runaway singularity that can come from it.
And the money that's being pumped into developing this technology is also now going into trying to sell the general public on this. Like, I don't know if you watched the Super Bowl a couple of days ago. It was a record number of people that tuned in for the Super Bowl. And there was a heavy presence of AI in trying to help the public understand just how good it's going to be for people. And there always is a sort of compromise, right? Like, it can be good, but can also get to a point where it becomes very bad too. And the bottom line is, if you start becoming too dependent on any one technology, whether you're talking about cell phones or computers or anything else, much less AI doing your thinking for you, that's got to be a net negative in the end, I would think.
I think so too. And you know, it's a dual use technology, like a lot of things are, you know, electricity or whatever, but it is, you know, it does have these abilities to be used nefariously. And, you know, there's a line in the book, you know, somebody's, because people ask me all the time, you know, are you for AI or against AI? I always start by saying, well, the research I did for my book was, you know, geared towards the dark side. I was looking for trouble with AI. But having said that, you know, my answer to them is like, well, what do you think of fire? Is fire good or bad? You know, if the fire's keeping you warm, it's good. If it's burning your house down, it's bad. And it's all in how it's used. And, you know, you talk about the PR campaign that these people are doing. You know, Sam Altman goes in front of Congress and says, you know, hey, I'm scared about, you know, I'm a gatekeeper and I'm scared about what we have hiding behind the gates here. So I want regulation. And meanwhile, he's fighting regulation in the EU. And meanwhile, while he's doing this and saying we should pause on making it more sophisticated till we have a better handling of it, he's, you know, going to the Saudis and getting billions of dollars for more development. So it's a little cynical about, you know, some of the ways they do the PR for it. But, you know, all we can do is hope that it is controlled enough.
Yeah, Altman in particular seems like he's doing a lot of talking out of both sides of his mouth. And I'm not sure what his current standing is with OpenAI, but here's the headline that I referenced a few minutes ago. OpenAI cuts military and warfare ban from permissible use policy. So at that point, like, we may not feel like that affects us right now. We may feel like the U.S. is at the forefront of this, so that it's only going to affect our enemies, so to speak. But this is something that is an enormous negative to humanity, because you're talking about computers making independent decisions on the types of weapons that they're firing and however many people they're choosing to kill as a result. And by the way, like, the U.S. isn't without enemies who are trying to advance this technology too.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. A few years ago, Google was working with the U.S. Department of Defense on something called Project Maven, which was using artificial intelligence to go over drone video feeds. And of course, these things always get sort of misconstrued by the general public. And it came out that Google was using AI with our military. So a bunch of Google employees, lots and lots of Google employees, signed this letter demanding that Google not work with the Department of Defense. So Google said, okay, we won't work on Project Maven anymore. Meanwhile, they've got hundreds of contracts with Chinese companies, all of whom are beholden to the Chinese Communist Party, and it's all dual use stuff. So even if it's, you know, the Project Maven was not as nefarious as a lot of other things that are going on. So I think we're still, you know, the ethics of all this still really have to be ironed out. And I don't think you can leave it up to the people who stand to benefit. I'm a laissez-faire capitalist, you know, guy overall, but, you know, regulation has helped with landmines and has helped with nuclear war. And, you know, nothing works perfectly, but, you know, you could say, well, gosh, you know, what would child labor laws be? You know, what would child labor be like if we didn't, you know, have passed labor laws? So I do feel like there's some sort of regulation that needs to be done, because, as you said, these technologies are able to identify, target, you know, search for, find, and kill someone without any human anywhere on the kill chain, if that's what they want to do. So, you know, the potential for harm is really, really great.
Thank you to Upton Sinclair for helping to advance our labor laws here in this country. Do you hope, in maybe a small way, that the Chaos Agent has a small Upton Sinclair-like impact on how people look at AI, and maybe more of a consideration given to putting guardrails in place to help us avoid some of these things?
Well, I don't ever want to be preachy with any of my books, but at the same time, as I'm researching something, I have my worldview and I form opinions on things. And I learn things. I might be reading a really, really boring government document that is so not interesting. And I feel like, well, this is the service I provide to my readers, because I find the one line in there and I go like, all right, well, that's actually pretty fascinating. You know, I'm going to expand on that. I'm going to fictionalize it and make it very different than how it's, you know, how I'm reading it. And I hope that people take away something from it. All my books, my last book was about Russia's, you know, intelligence involvement with the Ukraine war and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, I have very strong opinions on it. You don't have to agree with my opinions, but if you decide to read the book, you're going to hear them. And, you know, hopefully that not even changes people's minds, but maybe just sort of like helps people understand things they might not know about.
Yeah. And considering the amount of research that you did specific to AI and how you admitted that you went looking for the dark side, you've already spelled some of this out. Is there anything else that was especially surprising to you in looking for that dark side about just the potential for harm with artificial intelligence on humanity?
Well, gosh, I mean, the state of robotics is growing very, very quickly. So there, you know, there are robots that would, you know, destroy you in a fight. And there's robot drones that can carry a payload that's a, you know, a robot dog, you know, with a 6.5 Creedmoor rifle on its back. These things have all exist in prototypes. And so just as there's people really advancing the AI side of it to where the decision making is going to be correct. And, you know, again, people that say it isn't sophisticated, artificial intelligence, the big language learning models have scored human level scores on the bar exam and the GRE and the SAT. So, I mean, it's pretty significant. As far as robotics, I mean, the leaps and bounds that have been made. So when you meld these two things together, I mean, it's, you know, it's potentially very different, you know, dangerous. And artificial intelligence has created novel, you know, chemical weapons, novel toxins for chemical weapons. You know, it's synthesized this stuff. It's defeated our best human pilots in simulators in air-to-air combat. So, you know, this is something we all need to be very aware of. It is kind of scary to me.
Yeah, Boston Dynamics is especially brilliant and maddening at the same time.
Yeah.
Put these videos out with the robot dogs who are dancing in unison to Jingle Bells or something. And then the next video is that same robot dog with one of those aforementioned guns attached to its back, just having dead aim out on a shooting range. Or they'll have the robot that's doing parkour through the warehouse. And then the next video is that same robot just having somebody take a Mark McGuire type swing with a metal pipe to it and it not even flinching.
Right. The balance on these things, it's just really incredible. And, you know, as I was writing the book, I kept telling myself, I really hope people go on to Google and like look and see this stuff, because, you know, if I read it in a book and I hadn't seen that stuff, I wouldn't believe that it was real, or I would, you know. So, you know, there are, you know, bipedal robots that can move more adroitly than humans in many ways. So, I mean, gosh, you know, who knows what's coming, but we got to buckle up.
We're going to shift away from the chaos agent for the second half of this interview, Mark, and get a little bit more personal, if that's okay, because you have been open about the writing process and how you've had to change that writing process over the years as you've added family. You now have a wife, three stepkids, four dogs. Is that the accurate number of pooches in the household now?
That's the number of dogs I just let out about 10 minutes ago. Yeah. So I think that's all I've got these days.
My goodness. I've got one wife, thankfully, just one, two kids and two dogs. And that seems like way too many species in the household at times. So kudos to you on that one.
Thanks a lot.
The biggest challenges as a parent in 2024, technology or otherwise?
Oh boy. You know, so I'm 3 years into this, being a stepdad, and the kids have a great relationship with their dad. And I actually have a great relationship with their dad. So that's all, you know, super smooth, and I have a great relationship with the kids. But I mean, to me, the big danger is, gosh, you know, I live in a town, sadly, that is like, has more crime than almost anywhere else in America. And, there's reasons we're not moving. We're staying here for family reasons, but you know, it's the crime has like gotten closer and closer to us. So now I have a 16-year-old who's driving and leaving the house, and my house is as secure as any house in Memphis as far as gates and cameras and, you know, guns and the training I have and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, every day you watch while your kids leave, and every day you watch here where I live in Memphis, it's, they just let a guy out on bond for attempted first degree murder. And first thing he did was went and shot four people kidnapped somebody or whatever, that's just sort of, so our government isn't really doing us any favors here. And to me in 2024, the most dangerous thing is, just keeping kids safe and also social media and TikTok and all these things that, there's really nothing good that comes out of this stuff as far as I'm concerned.
No, I don't know. You said you have a 16-year-old now. I don't know how young the youngest is. I've got a 9 and 7-year-old, and at least half their classes, they're in second and third grade, half their classes already have phones.
Yeah.
So I'm already receiving that pressure. And it's like, no, we're holding off on this for as long as possible. When you finally do get that technology, because there is a way to teach them how to use these things responsibly versus just having their face stuck to the screen for the entirety of a day, it's probably just going to be phone calls and text messages at first. And gradually you'll get more and more responsibility if you prove the ability to understand just the proper way to use these things. But there are a lot of people out there, and not trying to be too critical of other parents right now, but they've just kind of succumbed to the pressure that society places on it with regards to making sure that your kids are constantly satisfied with that that digital stimulation. But by the same token, how many of those kids are going to have a hard time just being present in the moment, or human to human interaction now, or much more importantly in the future, when you do actually have to be a little bit more independent and think on your feet and think more critically and not have your parents do all of that for you?
Yeah. We have rules, no phones at the table at dinner and stuff like that. So you pick your little battles and you fight them. And also there is some technology that's beneficial. I mean,
sure,
we can see when my 16-year-old, who's only been driving for about 2 months, we can see how fast she accelerates when she's in another part of town or whatever, because of technology. So that's a benefit. But there's so much to sort of be concerned about and to keep an eye on. And it's so different from when I'm 56 years old. So it's so different from when I grew up. The fact that, my stepdaughter can, FaceTime with her boyfriend, is kind of alarming to me, because my little head would have exploded when I was that age if I had those opportunities. So, things are always changing, and I'm always telling the kids when they think that I'm being a Luddite or I'm being too, old fashioned, I'm always like, yeah, my parents said the same thing, and your kids will say the same thing. And, it's just like, we're all playing our roles here and doing the best we can.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Now, you've had to change your writing process over the years, as you've admitted previously. You used to love to go to Starbucks first thing in the morning, put Rain on the headphones, and just pound out however many words is the goal for the day. But that's had to change. So even though you do more writing at home, in part because you're also getting recognized more in Memphis when you go to your local Starbucks, are you still writing with the Rain first thing in the morning when you do your writing?
Yeah, I usually have my headphones on and the sound of Rain. And I've been doing that since many, many years before I got published, when I was just working on writing, and it kind of distracts me. I'm fortunate that my office is detached from the main, from our house. It's kind of like, it was built for the in-laws of the previous owners. So it's just a little one bedroom, one bath office is where I am now. And it's 35 steps out the back door, and kids never come back here because there's nothing interesting back there here for them. And the dogs usually stay away. So it's pretty secluded, and I like it. I really did like going to coffee shops and stuff. And when I travel, I always go to coffee shops or hotel lobbies or something, somewhere out in public. I feel like I'm more responsible. I work harder, and I don't, drift as much. But yeah, here in Memphis, if I go to a coffee shop, within 10 minutes, somebody's going to sit down and ask me to write a book about their uncle or something. And, it's, if I'm trying to make it my workspace, that's kind of on me. I need to find a place that is my workspace.
So if you go to sleep overnight and a huge storm rolls through, and it's a storm that's lasting for a couple of hours, does that serve as a sort of idea incubator for you? Do you wake up in the morning like, ooh, I know where I can take this story next?
Yeah, stuff like that comes at the weirdest times. I'll be walking my dogs or working out or something like that. A lot of times I'll be listening to a podcast for research while I'm working out. And then I'll just say, wait, you need to stop this and just go into your brain while you're working out for a half an hour, because you're on the cusp of figuring some plot point out or whatever it is. And and then it'll come to me. The Sound of Rain is, I don't know why, it just sort of like it blocks out other things. It doesn't make me tired like it makes other people tired. Just I think I've just tuned my brain for that. And I've tried, you know, I have friends who are authors. They're like, you should listen to like really inspiring movie soundtracks and stuff like that. And I've tried that, and I just focus on the music. So it doesn't work for me. I need the white noise.
Walking's a huge one too. I mean, a leisurely walk, I should say. If you're having to walk swiftly through a crazy urban setting where if you're not paying attention, you're going to get run into or maybe get run over by a car. But yeah, that leisurely walk. I mean, the ancient philosophers were huge fans of that because it just allowed you to get into the inner passages of your brain, I guess, and think a little bit more creatively about things.
Yeah. So I, with my dogs, we have a 100-acre dog off leash dog park here in Memphis, about 15 minutes from my house. And certain times a year we go every day. And I've been on a really bad deadline since, I guess, November, and it's still going on into the release of this book. I've turned the book, this is for another book, I've turned it in, but I'm in the editing process. So I haven't had my afternoons free to take the dogs to the dog park, but that hour just walking around there every day is, I've gotten some of my best ideas.
So you said something in a YouTube video earlier today, actually, is when it came out. And I want to give the video credit because it was a really good conversation. Can You Survive This Podcast is the name of the YouTube show. Great show. Check it out. Mark has a great conversation with the host. But you said something in that conversation that I found so profound, and talking about really grinding at the start of your writing career, not really having any success early on, but still having a certain belief in self. It was something to the effect of, it seemed like every time I failed, I got a little bit closer to that end goal. Do you have a moment of failure or a biggest moment of failure from your life that provided you a profound lesson that you still carry with you to this day?
Oh my gosh, so many. I am not one of those navel gazing people. And I haven't had a lot of epiphanies in my life, but you know, I think of failure. I was going through some medical stuff in 2017. I was already an established writer or whatever, but I had some, a bad ankle surgery, and it was infected. There was a chance I was going to lose my foot. And I was on crutches, and every day for 8 weeks, I had to drive myself to an infusion clinic to get these antibiotics. And I'm on my crutches going through a rainstorm, because I had to. You have to go 7 days a week if you want to keep your foot. And I just remember going like, wow, this is bleak, like a, you know, Charles Dickens novel, you know, suddenly. And my life is, you know, I've had a lot of luck, you know, but some of my luck has been bad. And I just remember thinking, it's like, gosh, you get past this, and you know, you need to be one of those just goofy, positive people who cares what other people think, because you just need to sort of spread the fact that, you know, you're fortunate to be here, and other people should feel the same way. So, you know, that came behind me. You know, I've had other like my first book, I never even showed it to an agent. My second book, I showed it to an agent and he wasn't interested, but he thought I was a good writer. And my third book, he was like, hey, probably some agents would pick this up, but I think you could do better. And I remember thinking, could you give me the names of those guys you think might pick it up? Because I'd love to call them right now. But he was absolutely right. And he's my agent to this day. So I wrote the fourth book, which was The Gray Man. So yeah, like you said, I always felt like I was failing, but I was falling forward each time. And I was in a better position than I was a year ago. So, you know, I also really like to write. So that helps. People all the time will, you know, ask me for inspiration to write. And I'm just like, if you need inspiration from me, that's not really a good sign. You should just really enjoy doing it. And don't worry about, you know, inspiration. Just do it when you want to and because you want to.
Also in that Can You Survive This Podcast interview, you mentioned that you've experienced something since childhood that has really helped you as an adult and as a writer as well, called maladaptive daydreaming. I had not heard of this before, but it makes a lot of sense for me and actually one of my kids too. So what exactly is maladaptive daydreaming, and how is it so beneficial for you as an adult?
Well, I had never heard of it before, maybe 2 years ago. And I was just sort of describing my childhood to a buddy of mine who's a psychiatrist. And he's like, do you think you suffered from maladaptive daydreaming? And I'm like, Wow, I already know what that is. You know, just by the name, I was like, oh my God, you just described my entire life. And you know, and it benefits me in writing. It's definitely a detriment in other ways. You know, I was a kid that whose mind wandered, you know, in school to the extent that I didn't know where I was. And I think a lot of people probably have it. It's you know, maladaptive is kind of a hard word for it. You know, it's I just my mind liked being, you know, off doing its own thing whenever I had this sort of unstructured time in my life. And sometimes I guess when my time was structured, I was still daydreaming.
Well, and, I feel like a better term for it is you're just like a daydreamer.
Yeah.
Daydreaming is you just kind of getting lost in your own thought and the surroundings matter very little, right?
Right. And the maladaptive part is when they feel like it negatively impacts aspects of your life, which it probably did when I was younger in school and in my education. But now it's obviously a benefit. My wife will say that, you know, she'll come up to me and say, like, what are you thinking about right now? Because I've this, you know, distant look in my face. And I'm, you know, it's like, I'm thinking about how to land a plane backwards on an aircraft carrier or some, you know, thing that's going to be in a story. And it's just a natural way for my brain to work. And it's too late to change it now. And I should be thankful for it.
How dare kids not be totally focused on arithmetic or writing or reading or anything else in school? How dare they be thinking about anything else? Let's just throw Adderall or something else at them to make sure that they can stay laser focused on school at the age of 6 or 7.
Yeah, that's what's going on. Although I will say that I wish I had paid more attention in English class. That would have been really beneficial to me. I was not the best English student. And I always hasten to say that's not me going, you don't have to be a good English student to make it as a writer. It's like, God, that would help me every single day of my life. If I'd paid attention in 8th grade grammar, it really would have been beneficial.
Yeah. So I need to admit to you that I'm a huge fan of the Joe Rogan podcast. And it was pretty much a year ago to this day that you were on
really
Rogan Experience. What was that
yeah.
like?
I was nervous about it just because I'm not nervous about being in front of people. I'm just nervous about saying something, you know, that I regret and millions of people watching it. But I kind of have this issue and I'm doing it now. It's like after about 5 minutes of an interview, I kind of forget I'm an interview and I'm just talking. Yeah. And so I was kind of like, oh crap, you can't do that when, you know, on that stage. But I did totally. Joe like has no notes or anything. You just sit down and just start talking. And I kept like letting my, when, you know, look around, like, where's he getting all this stuff that he's talking to me about? And it was just out of his head. And we went for almost 3 hours. I'd gotten a, you know, a note from them saying like the interview would run about 3 hours. And I've watched millions of clips of his show on YouTube or anybody that's interesting to me, but I've never like watched a whole show. I had no idea. And I was sitting there going like, what do I have to talk to Joe Rogan about for 3 hours? And then, you know, 2 minutes with the guy and you're like, you don't have to worry about that. Just talk, you know, just he'll run the show and you just talk. So it was a lot of fun. And I didn't walk away, you know, upset that I'd said something I shouldn't have or didn't say something I should have.
You may be one of the top storytellers on the planet right now, considering just how many books you crank out, how many bestsellers you crank out, and just the quality of work remains as high as it is. I know that you say at some point you're going to have to slow down this pace, but hey, if you're able to keep it up right now, good for you on that. What's the key to a really good story, Mark?
Gosh, a key to a good story, well, I always tell writers, the first thing you have to know, I only know thrillers, so this is, you know, this is probably maybe not universal, but you have to know what your villain wants. And the better you know what your villain wants, the better you can build stuff around it. But there's a lot of aspects to it. I mean, you have to have characters that people care about, because it doesn't matter how good your plot is. If nobody cares about the characters, you know, it's nobody has that investment. And, you know, I try and write tension on every page. It's just kind of my mantra. It's not all gunfights. It's not all swinging, you know, off of a building. I want there to be tension in people's relationships and tension in, you know, the ticking clock and all these other things, I think help build the story. But I would say having a really good understanding of your villain's wants and building rich characters that people care about are probably the two most important things.
I think it may be a simple answer here, but what does the villain want in the Chaos Agent?
Well, I can't give away too much, but I will definitely say the the villain thinks he's outsmarted everyone else and has developed something that it's multi-layered, but there's something that the villain expects from his efforts, and it's more important than his own life, and it's more important than society. It's artificial intelligence is a villain in the book, because again, that I didn't go looking for it to be, but it's very much a human story with spies and human assassins and all these things as well. So that was the villains. There's a lot of villains in this book, to put it mildly.
And final question, Mark, what do you love about the Gray Man?
I like his, probably the worldview. I like sort of exploring different things that happen, currently, in the world, and developing that. I want to develop him as a character. I like the psychology of the character and thinking about that sort of stuff. I just really enjoy, I enjoy the series. Once I started working with Tom Clancy after my third book, I expanded the series to be a little less like Die Hard, a little less just straight action, and a little bit more, larger scale. And that seems to be my sweet spot. That's what I like to write about and think about. So I kind of have the series right where I want it. And I want to just make every book different from the last, and hopefully as good as or better than the last. That's my only ambition in life right now.
I think you continue crushing it over and over again. He is Mark Greaney, many time over best-selling author. And yes, the latest book in the Gray Man series is out now. It's the 13th installment. It's called The Chaos Agent. You get it now wherever books are sold. Mark, thank you so much for the time today. Really enjoyed the conversation. I know you've got another book, not Gray Man, but another novel coming out in June. I would love to catch back up then if you're up for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do it. Enjoyed this.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. And thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. Talk to you next time on Books on Pod.